This episode of the Potato Field with Spudman is brought to you by the 1-4 Group Incorporated, a leading supplier of innovative dormancy and sprout inhibiting products for the potato storage industry. They are dedicated to the continued development of new and improved post-harvest chemical applications through collaborative efforts with leading university researchers and private industry. Find out more at 1-4group.com. Welcome to the Potato Field with Spudman. This is your host, editor Spudman, editor Zeke Jennings. I am joined today from Maine by a couple of gentlemen from the Maine Potato Board, Executive Director Don Flannery and agronomist Jake Dyer. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hey, Zeke.
Hello. How are you, Zeke?
I'm doing good. It's good to see you guys through the Zoom session that we're recording on. I appreciate you both being here. First of all, Don, could you give a little bit of background? You've been with the Potato Board quite a while. Could you tell us about what you do and how long you've been with the board and just what your background is?
Sure. I have been here quite a while. I'm going on my 23rd year that I've been here. So it has been a while that I've been here. I've been around the potato industry most of my life. My family were seed farmers, and I farmed for a number of years back in the late 70s. I got done off on the farm, went to work in economic development for almost 8 years, I guess, and then had the opportunity through doing some consulting work with the Potato Board, and then came on about 2 years after that. So that's kind of my background, came off a farm, and here I am today, 23 years later.
And Jake, you're in charge of agronomy there for the board and the seed potato operation that you guys run. What's your background and how long have you been in your current position?
I started with the Potato Board in August of 2015. Prior to that, I worked for the University of Maine down in Orono, where I managed both the crop and the livestock research farms down there. I have a BS in sustainable agriculture from the University of Maine, and I was employed there for 17 years on the farms down there.
We're all wrapped up with harvest. We're recording just a few days before Thanksgiving, so you guys have been wrapped up with harvest a little while now. I understand it was just another tough growing season for you guys with the dry condition. Could you describe what conditions were like this year and what impact that drought has had on the crops there and just agriculture in general?
Yeah, sure, Jay. It was an extremely dry year, more so than we've seen historically in Aroostook County. It's been the driest on record. From pretty much Memorial Day through the middle of September, some areas got as little as 2 inches of rain, some areas spotty rain got as much as 7, which is still not much rain for a potato crop in Maine. It affected the potato crop here more so than it did potatoes grown outside of Aroostook and the central part of the state in southern Maine, mainly because those potatoes are all under irrigation. Here in Aroostook County, 25% or so of the crop is irrigated. So that had a dramatic effect there. It had an effect on the sat, the number of tubers under the plants, and also on the ability for those tubers to size. So we dug a small crop here, about 20% less than we harvested last year, and which puts potatoes in a tight supply here. Quality is good. I think everything that's in storage is good quality. There's just not enough of it. I think we're tight across the board. I think we'll be done shipping on the fresh side relatively early, even for Maine. Processors are managing their inventories, and seed is going to be tight here in Maine. And with a small crop on the seed side, that's going to affect us, you know, for the next couple of years, because it affected not only the older generation of seed, but also the younger generation of seed, which means that that's going to be tight for the next couple of years.
And for people that aren't familiar with Maine, Aroostook County is the northeastern tip. It's a huge county, huge chunk of land. And that is the prime potato growing areas. When you get up, if you think of the shape of Maine, the toe area, up there at the top near the Canadian border. Now, when I was out there in 2019, you guys mentioned that conditions had been trending to drier and drier in recent years, but nothing like this. Any ideas or adjustments that you can make moving forward on how to avoid this, or is it just a matter of being at the mercy of Mother Nature?
Well, maybe we'll double team this one a little bit, but it is obviously being at the mercy of Mother Nature to some degree. What you're seeing happen here, it has been dry. We've had 3 years where we've had dry conditions, obviously this one being the driest. And I think, you know, growers now, while I said we have 30% of our acres, 25-30% of our acres irrigated, I think you're going to find that more growers are looking at a couple of things, longer rotations, which will help mitigate some of that risk, but also looking at implementing supplemental irrigation. And when I say supplemental, even on a year like this past year, growers made of as dry as it was, might have put down, I don't know, Jake, what, 4 or 5 inches of water if they had it, yeah. Versus, you know, somewhere where they rely on irrigation that they put down 25, 30 inches of water. So I think that's where it's headed, don't you, Jake?
Yeah, I do. I think a combination of investment in irrigation equipment and water sources is going to be at the forefront on most growers' minds this year. For the past several years, growers have worked to diversify their rotations, get them out there longer, focus on green manures, and trying to build soil organic matter. And I see that trend continuing.
Now, as far as the soil itself, it's described as caribou loam. Describe what exactly caribou loam is and what are its characteristics?
Caribou loam is fertile soil. It's fairly deep. I think there's a vein of it that basically stretches from probably the New Sweden Washburn area down to Halton, which is a lion's share of Arista County potato production area. It has good nutrient holding capacities and abilities. It's fairly well drained. But it can also hold a fair amount of water. So it's some of the most, if not the most productive agricultural land in the state. Right now, it's a valuable resource. Growers are working to implement practices, stewardship practices in order to keep that soil on the farm. And we're fortunate to have it. It's rocky would be probably the one downfall that the soil has.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up that... What's the saying? If you farmed in Maine, you've picked rocks or something like that. It's that's something that you guys have to deal with is the stones. But overall, yeah. It's just a very, very healthy, fertile soil.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, one thing, and Jake, I should add into there, too. You know, we talk about Aroostook County and how big it is in the different areas. If you start at the southern tip of the county, if you look along a map and you look along the Maine-New Brunswick border, the southern end of the county, and where potatoes are grown, and you go to the northern end of the county, which we call the crown of Maine. It's not the foot, it's the crown of Maine up there. It's 100 miles. So, you know, there can be a lot of differences in soils, weather conditions, and everything else in that one growing area in along one stretch that isn't much more than 60 miles wide. So it's a unique place to raise potatoes. There's a lot of benefits, like we said, of the soils, but there's a lot of challenges. And when somebody says, well, you know, the crop in Aroostook County, what's it look like? There's never just a straight answer because of the size of the county itself.
And the growing season, what is it like there? When do you guys typically plant and when do you typically harvest? And beyond the dry conditions that you've experienced, what might a typical season be like?
In this part of the state where most of theirs are grown, if you can get in and start planting, you know, the second week of April or May, you're doing pretty well. In southern Maine, you'll see them get in much earlier than that, much more, maybe even a month earlier. They'll be in there in April. So you're planning usually the 1st of June, you know, end of May, 1st of June. And harvest here, for the most part, will start the third week of September. And everyone likes to be wrapped up by the you know, 10th to the 15th of October.
Does that dictate what kind of varieties that you might plant? I mean, do you tend to go with shorter season, or can you do pretty much whatever you want?
Well, I'll start, and maybe Jake might want to chime in. You know, we raise a lot of different varieties in Maine because of the seed industry and the garden trade and the processing sector of the state. So we raise a lot of varieties. We do have some longer season varieties, example, Russet Burbank. But you need, you know, you need all every day you can get to do a Russet Burbank crop here. A lot of our seed varieties, which go to, you know, maybe go to some other type of processing, be it chips or whatever it may be, or seed that we ship out of here up and down the East Coast for whatever use, those varieties are shorter season and, you know, those work really well. But with a long season variety like a Burbank, we need pretty much that whole season.
Jake, what type of cover crops, or excuse me, not cover crops, but rotational crops, are you a fan of?
For the most part, we typically grow a lot of cereal grain here, oats be it primarily. We do have a fair amount of barley acreage, not too much wheat. So a typical cash, alternate cash crop other than potatoes would be cereal. A lot of those cereals are undersown. We're pretty much on a three-year rotation for the most part, high majority of the growers. And that would look like potatoes 1 year. And then that would be a small grain with either a clover or a Italian ryegrass underneath it. And then once the grain is harvested, that green manure crop is allowed to grow that third year before being incorporated back into the ground. That's a rotation that works very well from an agronomic standpoint. You have a separation of plant families. I think there's a lot of benefits to having grass in potato rotations. One of the downsides is that it's not really that economical. Cereal grain doesn't typically tend to gross or net a lot of money per acre. And the benefit of having the green manure there is kind of hard to quantify from an economic standpoint. We know that there is a benefit because you see the improvement in the subsequent potato crop. However, there is substantial cost associated with that. We've done some work in the past on alternative cash crops. We've had a fair amount of acreage of field peas that we've worked with. Sunflowers have been a surprising crop that's taken off, not on any humongous scale, but they are, you know, grown. We've grown some dry beans. We have some growers that incorporate different produce crops, whether that be carrots or beets. And so the rotation is a work in progress, but primarily it's the cereal and green manure with the potato.
Now, how do you go about keeping your soils healthy? What kind of practices are you a fan of as far as, you know, whether it be fumigation, whether it be cover crops, whatever it might be?
Yeah, I think as long as you can, you know, balancing your soils, testing it frequently, you know, trying to basically keep a well-balanced soil is a big thing. Keeping it protected. You know, we have a lot of growers that now, before they go to harvest potatoes, they'll spread oats out in front of the harvester, you know, so when they're done harvesting, then you've got, you know, kind of a crop that will die over the winter. However, it does have enough time to put a root system on and hold that soil in place for erosion mitigation. I think anything that you can do to basically protect it, you know, reduce your tillage. Potatoes inherently were going to disturb the soil. However, in those non-potato years, if you can kind of reduce the amount of tillage that you're doing, that's going to certainly be a benefit.
What are some of the other challenges you guys face in that part of the country as far as insects or diseases? Is it, do you guys have anything unique that you deal with there?
For the last few years, disease pressure has been relatively low. You know, we've had such little rainfall and the humidity. I mean, it typically is humid here in the summertime. It's, you know, moderately warm. But the last few years, we really haven't had much moisture. So foliar diseases haven't really been a problem. Insects, we've got a pretty good on handle. Those aphids is something we struggle with. PBY, you know, we're always cognizant of that. We do have a lot of integration of process acres and, you know, intermixed with seed acres around. So, you know, it can be a challenge there with virus. For the most part, it's been okay. We haven't really had any major flare-ups. And, late blight's something that we're always looking at. Early blight lately has kind of, with the cycles of wet and dry. You know, when we do get a shower, you know, we're on the lookout for that. We've been doing some spore trapping, spore monitoring programs for the last several years in conjunction with some growers in New Brunswick. So we have basically around 45 sites along the entire north-south axis of the potato belt where we're monitoring for early blight, late blight spores 3 times per week. So we're kind of, you know, taking a proactive approach there.
We're going to take just a quick break here for a message from our sponsor. Do you struggle with black spot or pressure bruise in your potato crop? The team at 1-4 Group has a solution for you. Their biocontrol 1-4 site has proven time and again to be the best sustainable option for delivering high quality potatoes. Incorporate 1-4 site into your existing storage program for unprecedented success. Learn more at 1-4group.com. And now back to the podcast. Let's switch gears a little bit. One of the reasons the Maine Potato Board needs somebody like Jake is that the board has taken over the state seed program, and they actually administer acres. And that's a little bit of an unusual situation. Don, how did that whole situation come about? And what were the big challenges that you guys face into getting the greenhouse and the acres to where they are now?
Yeah, it is unique for an organization like ours or any other state organization to take on something like that. The Porter Seed Farm, the Maine Seed Potato Board, was created, established back right after World War II in 1946-47 by a group of growers that saw the need, the foresight, and saw the need that there needed to be a source of early generation seed for the Maine industry. So they put together a proposal and a program that they purchased the farm that's up in Masardis, which is somewhat isolated from all the other production area, and working with the state, borrowed the money from the state to purchase this farm and get it established. And at that time, they needed some place to house this organization, so they put it within the Department of Agriculture. And it went on that way up until, into the late 90s, I guess it was 2000. It was probably 2008. Under the Department of Ag, of course, they were running the operation under the department. There's a lot of things government should do and can do and ought to be doing. But it became obvious that one of the things they shouldn't be doing is running an early generation seed farm. And things had kind of gone downhill as far as the facility itself. And they have had lost a lot of customers. And the state, pretty much with budget constraints, were looking at a way to get out. And so they came to the industry and said, they kind of initiated what we call the shotgun clause. I went into the governor's office and he said, you get two choices. Either the industry takes the farm over or we close it down. So that's kind of how this whole thing started. It took us a little over a year. We put together a plan for the industry to take it over with the agreement of the commitment of the potato board. That after 3 years, we would do a reassessment, and if it wasn't going to work or we couldn't figure out how to make it work, the facility would close. So we took over operations in January of 2010. At that point in time, they had some old greenhouses and limited mini tuber production, mostly for themselves, a little bit that they sold. And they were raising 34, 35 acres of potatoes. And the whole thing was not sustainable. There was no way that you could charge enough for that acre, for that production you were selling to keep the facility running. So we knew we had to increase acres. We had to make investments. So we started doing that. We started making investments in the facility with greenhouses. And also replacing field equipment and going out and working with the buyers that we had and the buyers that we had lost on making sure we were providing them what they needed by variety and generation, and also looking at opportunities as it related to mini tubers and was there any opportunities there. So today we raise about 400,000 mini tubers, which most stay on the farm, but we do sell a considerable amount of those outside, mainly varieties that we do not plant in the field. We have, I think it's 40 varieties of mini tubers, 40 or 50 varieties of mini tubers in the greenhouse, and we plant 26 varieties out in the field. So obviously there's a lot of varieties that we raise in the greenhouse that we don't grow in the field. If you look at it this way, we had about 110 acres of production, field production of field year 1, 2, and 3 at the farm. So it's increased from 34, 35 acres up to that 110, 15 acres. So it is something that normally an organization like this wouldn't undertake. When we went into this, we understood that it was going to be a big commitment on behalf of the industry and staff here. Jake wasn't here when we headed down this road, but, and I don't know if it was in the fine print when we hired him, but he sure is involved in it now. But I did have, good staff here, good staff at the farm. George McLaughlin, Zeke, who you met, who's our engineer, Jeannie Tapley, they have been tremendous in helping this move along when we first started. And so that's how we, how we got there and where it is today. We're continuing to make adjustments and to our mix of what we raise to meet the industry demand, but we're also continuing to make investments. We're looking at, we just got done building a pond for irrigation water. We've got to make more of an investment there just to manage risk. We're hoping that we make the investment and we never turn a pump on. That would be the best case scenario, but we've got to manage that risk, because when that early generation seed supply is less than it should be, it has a tremendous impact on the industry for 3 to 4 years.
And as far as the varieties that you do, and whether it's the mini tubers or out in the field, what do you typically focus on, varieties that are going to all different industries, or does it really go more to processing, table stock, chippers?
It's kind of across the board. A lot of the mini tubers that we sell are smaller volumes. Then they tend to be the varieties that I call are going to the garden trade. They're old varieties, not a lot of production of them, and the growers take them directly. So that'd be a lot of varieties like Yukon that we don't have a lot of field production in now. Older varieties like Kennebec and Katahdin and some of those. So that's kind of the focus on the sale of the mini tubers. On our field production, it's market driven. It really is. We have varieties that go to, fresh seed, to seed growers that go out to the seed growers themselves for fresh and processing. And it's really market driven. We've seen a tremendous mix or change in the mix over the last six or eight years on some of the varieties that have come and gone and some that have stayed. Russet Burbank has been there forever and will probably always be in that mix forever. But you've seen new varieties come on, whether a chip variety like a Lamoka or Juanita, or processing varieties like the Caribou. Russet, and then you've got old standbys, Dark Red New Orleans and Atlantics and some of those. So it does change, but it's market driven.
And yeah, you mentioned the Caribou, which was developed by the University of Maine breeding program, which is led by Greg Porter, who I met when I was out there. And you guys work closely with the breeding program. Could you talk a little bit about that relationship and how you guys work together to get new varieties up and going, tested, and out in the field?
You want to tackle that one, Jay?
Sure, I can do some of it. Basically, with Dr. Porter, we have a research committee that meets every year. We do have a pool of money that we set aside in order to help fund some of these research projects. So we've funded some of Greg's work as breeding programs, as statewide variety trials, et cetera, for several years now. Greg does a lot of work at the farm in Presque Isle. He's got lots of, you know, both from the initial cross all the way up to the advanced material that might have been, 7 years now, if not longer, in the ground. So he's constantly evaluating new material. We do have an arrangement, Don can speak more to this, on what, when, you know, a promising variety like the Caribou comes up. But it's been a good relationship. There's a lot of promising material, I think, in Greg's pipeline. And it seems to be working well, especially in cases like the Caribou Russet.
Yeah, and with Greg's program, once he gets a variety up to the point where, you know, he's got probably 5 or 6 years advanced assessment on it, what he'll do is we get the tissue culture, he gets the tissue culture cleaned up so we can bring it into our tissue culture lab. And then we'll bring it in to the tissue culture lab at the seed farm. And then we start propagating some material to go out for some additional onto seed farms with clean seed to ramp those varieties up to do more of a commercial assessment. So, you know, the industry partners with him with funding and, you know, that sort of thing. And then the seed side of it, the seed farm part of it, takes the next step. It helps them propagate that up so we can get it on some seed farms and get it propagated to a level we can do some commercial trials.
And we've touched on the Caribou Russet already. Don, maybe you could talk a little bit about why this has been such a good variety for you guys, and then maybe Jake, you can add to what it's like to grow and maybe give some feedback on that side.
Yeah, early on when that variety was coming through, once we got it at the seed farm, there were some processing trials that had been done and, you know, some people had looked at it and it was very favorable. But we had it on the farm for propagating and getting some volume up there for probably 4 years. And it just really performed well. It's a nice looking potato. The type of it, it grew well. The plants withstood dry conditions really well, seemed to tolerate disease really well. So we kind of promoted it out there that it would be, a good variety, a true variety that is multi-purpose. Because we thought the pack out on it would be good on the fresh side, the appearance would be good on the fresh side, and it had a lot of processing characteristics. So, you know, that's when we started, and we got a little more aggressive with Caribou Russet because of what we saw in it and what we were hearing back on propagating the volume sooner than we normally would. So that worked really well, and it really has become a variety that is a true dual-purpose potato. It does process. It processes well. It does look like a russet, not as deep and netted skin as a Burbank, but it has a russeted skin. And on the table market, it's tight, and the pack out on it is, you know, is really good. One of the biggest things about it, which is really good, is that it will get you a decent yield much earlier than a russet Burbank. So in our case here in Maine, I mean, you can get over, our average in Maine is about 320 hundredweight per acre. You can get 300 and above on a Caribou Russet in 90 days, which is, you know, far, far better than a Burbank. So, you know, it just has really taken off because I think of those two reasons. It's a true, you know, a dual purpose, and for a shorter season area like us, you can get a yield off of it.
The Caribou, it's not a heavy setting potato, so there's usually not a lot of tubers per hill. They do tend to get large. It's a nice mid-season, I would say, variety. A lot of the processing acres of Caribou here goes right to the plant from the field. Not a lot goes into storage. The growers really seem to like the Caribou because it does give them, like Don said, it gives you a nice yield earlier in the season. It's a moderate, you know, it has moderate nutrient demand, real high percentage of payables. You know, I've talked to some growers and they're getting 98-99% payables when they deliver to the processing plant. You know, it basically it's a good grower's variety. You know, there's not a whole lot of downside to it. You know, I think the first few years it was kind of tricky to figure out your seed space and, you know, your nutrient use and stuff like that. But now, like I said, from the process end, the percentage of 10 ounces is real high. And I think I like it because it is a grower's variety.
Up until World War II, and this may not be common knowledge, you know, in American consumers today, but up until World War II, Maine was the potato growing capital of the U.S. And then, you know, after World War II and irrigation, kind of switched to Idaho, but you guys still grow a lot there. And a lot of your farms have a lot of history. There's a lot of pride in agriculture in your state. You've had, as far as the marketing side of things, some real success with marketing Maine potatoes. Could you talk a little bit about that in that pride in Maine potatoes and how that's been a success for you guys?
Yeah, you know, we've started off, you know, a few years ago, believing that, you know, a lot of people want to know where their food comes from and where their potatoes come from. The Maine fresh market industry is mainly the East Coast and has been and starting to change some, but a strong part of that has been around white potatoes. And, you know, we started working with retailers and our dealers and our packers started working with retailers to, you know, either on the bag or some way identifying that they're from Maine. We didn't do it this year because of COVID, but every year we do the Eastern States Exhibition, which is in West Springfield, Massachusetts. And we sell 2 trailer loads of baked potatoes down there. And you get people from Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York, Rhode Island, I mean, that whole Pennsylvania, that whole area. And they come in and say, why can't I find these potatoes in my store? I want to buy Maine potatoes. And so we started kind of a campaign with limited resources and doing it was successful. Positive feedback. Tough to do in retail because it's a change and it was tough. But when we rolled out the Caribou Russet, we had a name with that potato. And what we did early on, even the first year, we had very limited amount to put at retail. The packers that had it, they were putting them out there, and we reached out to mainly, you know, retailers in Maine and said, this needs to be sold, bagged, packaged, and so it says Caribou Russet on it. And it was absolutely amazing, the feedback we got. It's a good potato, but people, the feedback we got, that how many people could go in, they could see it on the bag, and it said Caribou Russet, and it was the same potato they bought the week before and the week after. What we ran into that first year is limited supply. So the next year, we had much more supply to send to retail, but what we ran into was when we were out, people were calling us and calling the dealers and calling the retail and saying, how come I can't get them? And so we had to explain to them, it's a little bit like Vidalia onions. There's a season for them. And the season is, you know, from the 1st of October until the 1st of May, and that's when you're going to find Caribou Russets. But it has been really, you know, I guess it really wasn't surprising, but it was really nice to see that once people know what the product is, know how to find it and make it easy for them to find it, and it's a good product, they will come back. And I think that since we've done that, you've seen Green Thumb Farms do their Gold River or Cold River variety bag. And you've seen some other packers here in Maine do some other things with identifying that. Green Thumb's also doing this year Fenway Red. It's not a Maine variety, but they're doing a Fenway Red. And people recognize it. They want to come, if they like it, they'll come back and get it. So if you can tie in the Northeast, if you can tie Maine, the name Maine, and you can identify it, it does make a difference at retail. You got to give them a quality product, and it's got to be a good product, but they will come back and look for it.
And I know the Irvings were even working with like restaurants and, you know, food service, you know, getting that, hey, we serve Maine potatoes right on the menu.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we did that early on with Caribou to the point where even though limited amount of restaurant business is going on here in Maine at this time, I was in a store the other day and ran into somebody and they had been to a restaurant in Bangor. And they were, again, doing their Caribou Russet promotion within their restaurant. So
It has got, it's been successful. And I think there's a lot of opportunities out there for the industry, not only in Maine, but for the industry to work with retail, work with, you know, the restaurant chains and feature those sorts of things.
Both of you guys, Don especially, because, you know, of his administrative role, but both of you guys are in contact with a lot of growers in your state and otherwise because of, you know, your customers and everything. What are you guys hearing this year as far as the biggest challenges that are facing growers in your neck of the woods or growers that you sell seed to?
You want to go first, Jay?
Sure. I think the biggest challenge this year for growers is going to be number one, seed supply. You know, it seed is going to be tight this year. And the other concern or the other priority is going to be irrigation is my feeling.
Yeah. And I think ongoing, you know, I think Jake's right. But ongoing, you know, our growers aren't much different in many ways of growers in other areas. Labor's a problem. You know, farming, potato growing isn't like it was 40 years ago. Labor, even though there's not as much manual labor that's needed, you need quality labor. That becomes one that's always out there. You know, Jake mentioned early on about the rotational crops. Our growers are constantly working on improving soil health. You know, those are things that they're working on. And, you know, I think one of the other things, it goes along with risk management and how you do it. But, you know, potatoes are not a cheap crop to raise. And, you know, I think one of the challenges is going to be is controlling those input costs and knowing that things continue, you know, inputs continue to increase. But what can you do on the agronomic side, you know, like Jake had talked about, to manage those input costs? So, you know, some of that is across the board. It's no different in Maine than it is in Idaho or Washington or Colorado. But short term, I think, you know, in the seed side for our growers and for the growers we supply up and down the East Coast, you know, the seed thing is going to be a something that's going to be a challenge for the next 2 to 3 years. Even this year outside of Maine, seed is very tight. So that's going to be a challenge, a short term challenge that has a, you know where the end of it is once you get there. But, you know, other than that, it's those sorts of things that are constantly on growers' minds.
Now, you guys have a big processing presence in that part of the state. You have a huge McCain facility in Easton. Penobscot McCrone just opened a new facility that we were out there when they were breaking ground. Do you know approximately, as far as the commercial farms, about what percentage goes to processing?
Yeah, the numbers we use are pretty consistently and don't change a lot as far as percentages go. You look at the potatoes that are grown in Maine, about 65% of those potatoes are processed. Roughly 20% of our production goes to seed, and the other 15 or so any given year is fresh potatoes now. That being said, our seed industry is heavily weighted towards processing potatoes, either for our main growers or for growers outside the state. So, you know, when you combine the seed side of our industry that's supporting the processing and the 65% of the processing side, if you kind of put them together, you're probably going to be more at, you know, 75% of our industry has either direct or indirect connection with processing.
Well, and with the loop that COVID threw on food service, you know, really affected processing. What's it been like there? You know, it's going to affect the commercial farms and it's going to affect all the way back to seed. What's the impact been like with the food service, you know, shutdowns?
Yeah. Well, obviously early on in March and April of last year, this year, it was a pretty bleak picture when everything shut down and processors were looking at nowhere to go with the finished product, which meant the grower had nowhere to go with the raw product and the seed grower had nowhere to go with the seed to sell to the grower. Luckily, as some things opened up in the market, you know, things got somewhere close to being where we are, whatever normal this is, that business picked up. So the vast majority of the 2019 crop in Maine that was headed to processing was used.
The seed growers did have some impact on seed that was turned back that was going to be required for the 20 crop because there were some contract adjustments made. So our seed growers did have some seed that wasn't able to be moved. The fresh market for the 19 crop, people were eating at home, so there was a strong demand for the fresh side. Going into the 20 crop, what we saw was there were some adjustments in contract volumes. So I think we were down 1,000 acres, whatever the USDA said we were down. Mainly that was focused around the seed or around the processing side. Seed growers did cut some acres because not knowing going into what was going to happen. And the table side of our business stayed pretty much the same. So,
well, do you see the need or hear anything from the growers as far as changes in the setup and how we contract processing acres? I mean, do you think COVID has revealed, you know, some tweaks, or is it just a matter of it was a once in a lifetime thing? Otherwise the system works.
I think for the most part, you know, it's a once in a lifetime thing, but there are some recognitions that, you know, I think maybe we got to look a little bit more as to some fallback plans when things happen. But I think that everyone, the system works pretty well once we get back to normal. I'm sure the processors are looking at contingency plans and how do we deal with this. And from the grower side, the uncertainty of what next spring is going to bring. The contracting system works fine, but we never know until you get there. And we never, under this environment, you know, one would assume that whatever volumes are out there to now, they'll probably stay this way for a while. When are we going to get back to the volumes and the sales that we had in March March and April of 19? Who knows? I think it's going to be a while. So I think it's the unknown that everybody is trying to deal with.
Well, on that note, we've covered a lot of ground. Thank you both very much for your time. You can catch this episode and all the other episodes we've recorded at spudman.com/podcast. Guys, thank you so much for your time. Have a great holiday season, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks, Zeke.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And thanks again to 1-4 Group, our sponsor. Be sure to go check them out at 1-4group.com.